Front Pages. For the next hour, Chris will bring you the front page news from the morning newspapers, the latest headlines from around the state and around the rest of the world.
Hello, it's Sunday, April 28th, the last Sunday in April of 2024. I'm Lisa Bowman, and reading the front pages of the Hartford Courant, the New York Times, and the Manchester Journal-Enquirer with me is Scott Becker. Now we'll take a look at the pictures on the front pages of today's papers. We'll begin with the New York Times. At the very top of the paper, above the fold, in the center of the paper, is a very large picture of Nelson Mandela. He is the former leader of South Africa. And you can see him, he is in the center of the picture. He is turned slightly, we're seeing him first of all from the waist up, along with the people next to him. He is in a stadium that is packed full of people. Behind him, you see tiers of seating that are like, they look like escalators on pillars. And they are behind him. There's one that is high that is in back of him, then a little bit lower next to it, and a little bit lower next to it. And then we see Nelson Mandela standing in the center of the picture with these three tiers of stadium seating behind him. He is turned slightly to his right. He has his right hand in the air in the shape of a fist. And he is wearing a green long sleeve shirt with some white decoration on it. And next to him are some gentlemen to his left and to his right. Two gentlemen are wearing basically black short sleeve or longish sleeve shirts, depending upon which person we're looking at. They have a red rose on their left lapel, and there is yellow piping down the center of the shirts. And then there's a couple of other gentlemen to Mr. Mandela's right. One is in a blue sports jacket, blue shirt, and he is standing. And then there's a person that's sort of sitting or kneeling, maybe a little bit below these gentleman, and he has on a white visor, and we're just seeing him basically from the neck up. And this has to do with a story that we'll be bringing you right after we get done with the pictures, which is about has South Africa overcome apartheid? Down below that picture, at the bottom of the page, directly below that picture and below the fold, we see a picture of a nurse. She is standing in front of what looks to be the medical complex, possibly where she works. She has a little bit longer than shoulder length blonde hair. She has on blue scrubs, short sleeve shirt, and long pants. And she has sneakers on. And the one noticeable thing is that she has a prosthetic foot. And this is a story that has to deal with that her attempts to enlist in the military have been denied because of the prosthetic. And there's one more picture on the front page of today's New York Times, and that is to the right of this nurse. And it is an oil painting, and it is a portrait of Richard III. That is obviously not in this country, but in Britain. And we see him, basically the oil painting has him pictured under a gold arch. It is from the chest up. He is facing to his right. He has on black cap with a flower decoration on that cap, long brown hair, has sort of a stern, wistful look on his face as he is, again, is looking off to the right. And then he has his gold cape over his shoulders with the necklace of his office. And this has to do with the story about how they have been researching the remains of Richard III, and now they're trying to uncover the mystery whether indeed he killed his nephews, which were the princes at that time. Moving on to pictures in the Hartford Courant, there are two pictures in the Hartford Courant. The first one, very, very large in the center, above and below the fold, and it is of a soccer player. We see behind the soccer player a stadium seating, bleacher seating that is blurred out but has people in it. We see a player in front of that bleacher that is on the field, again blurred out, but wearing a green sports shirt, the team shirt probably, navy blue shorts, green socks up to just below the knees, and sneakers. And then we move into the foreground and we see this player, who again is wearing the team shirt, green short sleeve shirt, navy blue shorts, green socks up to just below the knee, and sneakers that are orange with cleats on them. And this has to do with a player for the Hartford Athletic, which is our hometown soccer team. And this player comes from a small town in Ghana, and he is describing how he moved from an orphanage in that country to a pro soccer player here in Connecticut. The last picture we have is that we have a picture from New York, and we see student protesters in this picture. So the picture behind them, we see some buildings. They might possibly be academic buildings. It's hard to tell, but they look like office type buildings, glass all around on two sides of the building. And as we move into the foreground, we see these student protesters. We see one standing to the left, wrapped in a scarf with some sort of head covering on, and then dark clothing on the rest of the way down. In front of that person, we see some umbrellas that are tilted, sheltering some coolers. We see some, they look like little pup tents that are set up near that person. We see another person, there's a tree in the very center of the picture, and we see a person in a scarf, a Palestinian scarf, I believe, with a gray sweater and dark pants on, leaning up against that tree. And as we move to the right, we see the backs of some more students with backpacks on, facing away from us with the picture. And this has to do with anti-war activists that are, and student protests that are happening on campuses around the country. So with that, we are moving on to our first stories of the day. And our first stories of the day deal with international news. And our first story is entitled, Putin's War Will Soon Reach Russians' Tax Bills. Russia's president has signaled an increase in income and corporate taxes that will help finance the war. The moves reflect his firm control over Russian policy. President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia appears on track to institute a rare tax increase on corporations and high earners, a move that reflects both the burgeoning costs of his war in Ukraine and the firm control he has over the Russian elite as he embarks on a fifth term in office. Financial technocrats in Mr. Putin's government are searching for new ways to fund not just the war, but also a broader confrontation with the West that is likely to remain costly for years. Russia is allocating nearly a third of its overall 2024 budget to national defense spending this year, a huge increase, adding to a deficit that the Kremlin has taken pains to keep in check. The proposed tax increase underscores Mr. Putin's rising confidence about his political control over the Russian elite and his country's economic resilience at home, showing that he is willing to risk alienating parts of society to fund the war. It would represent the first major tax overhaul in over a decade. I think that this is a real sign of how comfortable he is, said Richard Connolly, an expert on the Russian economy at Oxford Analytica, a strategic analysis firm. The fact that they are doing it They are looking to repair the house whilst the weather is good, or at least reinforce the walls from a fiscal point of view. Military spending and high oil prices have buoyed the Russian economy and driven up wages, despite causing higher inflation and shortages in the labor market. That is probably leading financial officials to see the current moment as a good time to push through tax increases. Those responsible for paying Russia's bills cannot predict how much Mr. Putin's future geopolitical moves will cost or whether Western sanctions will further limit income. From Moscow's point of view, they are looking in pretty good shape, and now is a good time to do these things, Mr. Connolly said. Even the people it will fall on have had a good couple of years and look like they are going to have a good year ahead. Few details are known about the planned increase. In a speech on Wednesday, Mr. Putin said his government was assessing various proposals. He said the new tax arrangements would remain fixed for a long period to ensure stability. Our next story is entitled, Suddenly Chinese Spies Seem to Be Popping Up All Over Europe. A flurry of arrests this week reflect the continent's newly toughened response to Beijing's espionage activities and political meddling. One of the men, a young Briton known for his hawkish views on China, worked as an aide to a prominent member of the British Parliament. Another, a German citizen of Chinese descent, was an assistant to a member of the European Parliament, representing Germany's far right. While from different countries and seemingly divergent backgrounds and outlooks, both men became ensnared this week in accusations of espionage on behalf of China, and a widening pushback in Europe against malign Chinese influence in politics and commerce. In all, six people in three separate cases have been charged this week in Europe with spying for China, two in Britain and four in Germany. On Friday, as the two Britons made an initial court appearance in London, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony J. Blinken, met in Beijing with China's leader, Xi Jinping, in the latest effort by the two rivals to keep communications open even as disputes escalate over trade, national security, and geopolitical frictions. The espionage cases in Britain and Germany, the first of their kind in two countries that once cultivated warm relations with Beijing, served as eye-catching exclamation points in Europe's long, often anguished breakup with China. Shortly after British and German officials announced that six of their citizens had been charged with espionage, the Dutch and Polish authorities on Wednesday raided the offices of a Chinese security equipment supplier as part of a crackdown by the European Union on what it sees as unfair trading practices. It was the first time that the bloc's executive arm, the European Commission, had used a new anti-foreign subsidy law to order a raid on a Chinese company. In early April, Sweden expelled a Chinese journalist who had been a resident of the country for 2 decades, saying the reporter posed a threat to national security. After years of regular tiffs over trade, followed by reconciliation, Europe has lost patience with China, said Ivana Karaskova, a Czech researcher at the Association for International Affairs, an independent research group in Prague, who until last month served as an advisor to the European Commission on China. China still has steadfast friends in the European Union, notably Hungary, she added. In the multidimensional chess game between the world's two largest economies after the United States. But Europe, Ms. Karakova said, has moved from a position of total denial in some quarters over the danger posed by Chinese espionage and influence operations to take a less naive view and wants to defend European interests vis-a-vis China. Our next story is entitled, Has South Africa Truly Defeated Apartheid? When the apartheid government was toppled in South Africa, ending white minority rule, people around the world shared in the excitement and optimism that a more just society would emerge. And generation later, The country's journey provides a broader lesson. It is far easier to rally for an end to racism than it is to undo entrenched inequalities and to govern a complicated country. The African National Congress won the 1994 election on the promise of a better life for all. But for many, that promise has fallen short. Polls now suggest that in the election scheduled for May 29th, the party risks losing its absolute majority in the national government for the first time. No one doubts that South Africa has made strides since the days of legalized racial oppression. Democracy has brought a growing Black middle class, access to better education across racial lines, and a basic human dignity once stolen from the Black majority. But there also has been a widening gap between rich and poor, a breakdown in basic services like electricity and water, and the continued isolation of Black families stuck in ramshackle homes in distant communities. Black South Africans, who make up 81% of the population, often argue that they've gained political freedom, but not economic freedom, and remain trapped in the structure of apartheid. We went through the Freedom Charter's declarations, each ending in an exclamation point, to measure South Africa's progress and shortcomings over the past 30 years. On a continent where coups, autocrats, and flawed elections have become common, South Africa is a widely admired exception. Since 1994, the country has held national elections every 5 years, with local elections in between. Presidents have changed, but the party in power, the ANC, never has. Despite this, there have never been any serious doubts about the integrity of those electoral contests. A record 52 parties will compete in the national election this year. Despite the electoral stability, politics has been dangerous. Fierce conflict within the ANC has resulted in many assassinations over the years. The ANC's access to state resources as the governing party has fueled many of the disputes and led to widespread corruption, from top national officials down to local councillors. The enrichment of ANC leaders, while many people barely earn enough to feed themselves, has shaken the faith of many South Africans in their democratic system. Last year, 22% of South Africans approved of the functioning of the country's democracy, down from 63% in 2004, according to surveys from the Human Sciences Research Council. Our next story is entitled, Bank Lines Frustration Grow as Cuba Runs Short of Cash, Dateline Havana. Alejandro Fonseca stood in line for several hours outside a bank in Havana, hoping to withdraw Cuban pesos from an ATM. But when it was almost his turn, the cash ran out. He angrily hopped on his electric tricycle and traveled several kilometers to another branch, where he finally managed to withdraw some money after wasting the entire morning. "It shouldn't be so difficult to get the money you earn by working," Fonseca, 23, said. He is one of an increasing number of frustrated Cubans who have to grapple with yet another hurdle while navigating the island's already complicated monetary system, a shortage of cash. Long lines outside banks and ATMs in the capital, Havana, and beyond start forming early in the day as people seek cash for routine transactions like buying food and other essentials. Experts say there are several reasons behind the shortage, all somehow related to Cuba's deep economic crisis, one of the worst in decades. Ovar Evelini Perez, a Cuban economist and university professor, says the main culprits are the government's growing fiscal deficit, the non-existence of banknotes with a denomination greater than 1,000 Cuban pesos, about $3 in the parallel market, stubbornly high inflation, and cash not being returned to banks. There is money, yes, but not in the banks, Perez said. Most of the cash is being held not by salaried workers, but by entrepreneurs and owners of small and medium-sized business, Who are more likely to collect cash from commercial transactions? This, Perez says, is either because they don't trust the local banks or simply because they need the Cuban pesos to convert into foreign currency. Most entrepreneurs and small business owners in Cuba have to import almost everything they sell or pay in foreign currency for the supplies needed to run their businesses. As a consequence, many end up hoarding Cuban pesos to later change into foreign currency on the informal market. Converting those Cuban pesos to other currencies poses another challenge because there are several highly fluctuating exchange rates on the island. For example, the official rate used by government industries and agencies is 24 pesos to the US dollar, while for individuals, the rate is 120 pesos to the dollar. On the informal market, the dollar can fetch up to 350 Cuban pesos. Perez notes that in 2018, 50% of the cash in circulation was in the hands of the Cuban population, and the other half in Cuban banks. But in 2022, the latest year for which information is available, 70% of cash was in the wallets of individuals. Well, now's the time when we take a look at your weather. Today, Sunday, a morning shower, otherwise rather cloudy, high 72, low 59. Monday, very warm with periods of clouds and sun, high 79, low 52. Tuesday, variable clouds, cooler, a PM thunderstorm, high 65, low 50. Wednesday, partial sunshine, high 63, low 46. And Thursday, pleasant and warmer with some sun, high 75, low 51. Now we'll take a look at stories that are more of national interest. Our first story is entitled Biden Officials Indefinitely Postpone Ban on Menthol Cigarettes Amid Election Year Pushback. Dateline Washington. President Joe Biden's administration is indefinitely delaying a long-awaited menthol cigarette ban, a decision that infuriated anti-smoking advocates but could avoid a political backlash from Black voters in November. In a statement Friday, Biden's top health official gave no timeline for issuing the rule, saying only that the administration would take more time to consider feedback, including from civil rights groups. It's clear that there are still more conversations to have, and that will take significantly more time, Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra said in a statement. The White House has held dozens of meetings in recent months with groups opposing the ban, including civil rights organizers, law enforcement officials, and small business owners. Most groups have financial ties to tobacco companies. The announcement is another setback for Food and Drug Administration officials who drafted the ban and predicted it would prevent hundreds of thousands of smoking-related deaths over 40 years. The agency has worked toward banning menthol across multiple administrations without ever finalizing a rule. The decision prioritizes politics over lives, especially Black lives, said Yolanda Richardson of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids in an emailed statement. It is especially disturbing to see the administration parrot the false claims of the tobacco industry about support from the civil rights community. Richardson noted that the ban is supported by groups including the NAACP and the Congressional Black Caucus. Previous FDA efforts on menthol have been derailed by tobacco industry pushback or competing political priorities, with both Biden and former President Donald Trump vying for the support of Black voters. The ban's potential impact has been scrutinized by Republicans and Democrats heading into the fall election. Anti-smoking advocates have been pushing the FDA to eliminate the flavor since the agency gained authority to regulate certain tobacco ingredients in 2009. Menthol is the only cigarette flavor that wasn't banned under that law, a carve-out negotiated by industry allies in Congress. but the law instructed the FDA to continue studying the issue. More than 11% of U.S. adults smoke, with rates roughly even between white and black people. But about 80% of black smokers smoke menthol, which the FDA says masks the harshness of smoking, making it easier to start and harder to quit. Also, most teenagers who smoke cigarettes prefer menthols. Our next story is entitled Police Officer Hiring in U.S. Increases in 2023 After Years of Decline, Survey Shows. Dateline Philadelphia. Police departments across the United States are reporting an increase in the ranks for the first time since the COVID-19 pandemic and the 2020 killing of George Floyd, which led to an historic exodus of officers, a survey shows. More sworn officers were hired in 2023 than in any one of the previous 4 years, and fewer officers overall resigned or retired, according to the 214 law enforcement agencies that responded to a survey by the Police Executive Research Forum, or PERF. Floyd's death at the hands of Minneapolis police officers spurred nationwide protests against police brutality and heightened scrutiny of law enforcement. As more and more officers left, many of the departments had to redeploy stretched resources by shifting officers away from investigative work or quality of life issues, such as abandoned vehicles or noise violations, to handle increases in crime. And in some cases, the shortages meant slower response times or limiting responses to emergencies only, police officials say. I just think that the past 4 years have been particularly challenging for American policing, said Chuck Wexler, executive director of PERF, a nonprofit policing think tank based in Washington, D.C. And our survey shows we're finally starting to turn a corner. Individual departments are turning that corner at different rates, however, according to Wexler, who noted many still struggling to attract and keep officers. As a whole, the profession isn't out of the woods yet, he said. The Associated Press left phone and email messages with several unions and police departments to ask about increased hiring. The survey shows that while small and medium departments had more sworn officers than they did in January 2020, large departments are still more than 5% below their staffing levels from that time, even with a year-over-year increase from 2022 to 2023. The survey also showed smaller departments with fewer than 50 officers are still struggling with a higher rate of resignations and retirements. The survey asked only for numbers, Wexler said, so it's hard to say whether those officers are leaving for larger departments or leaving the profession altogether. He also said smaller departments, which account for 80% of agencies nationwide, were underrepresented in the responses PERF received. Our next story is entitled How Abrupt U-Turns Are Defining U.S. Environmental Regulations. The polarization of politics means that rules are imposed, gutted, and restored with each election. Experts say that's bad for the economy. The Biden administration's move on Thursday to strictly limit pollution from coal-burning power plants is a major policy shift. But in many ways, it's one more hairpin turn in a zigzag approach to environmental regulation in the United States, a pattern that has grown more extreme as the political landscape has become more polarized. Nearly a decade ago, President Barack Obama was the Democrat who tried to force power plants to stop burning coal, the dirtiest of the fossil fuels. His Republican successor, Donald J. Trump, effectively reversed that plan. Now President Biden is trying once more to put an end to carbon emissions from coal plants. But Mr. Trump, who was running to replace Mr. Biden, has promised that he will again delete those plans if he wins in November. The country's participation in the Paris Climate Accord has followed the same swerving path. Under Mr. Obama, the United States joined the global commitment to fight climate change, only for Mr. Trump to pull the US out of it and for Mr. Biden to rejoin. If Mr. Trump wins the presidency, he is likely to exit the accord again. Government policies have always shifted between Democratic and Republican administrations, but they've generally stayed in place and have been tightened or loosened along a spectrum, depending on the occupant of the White House. But in the last decade, environmental rules in particular have been caught in a cycle of erase and replace whiplash. In the old days, the regulatory days of my youth, we were going back and forth between the 40-yard lines, said Douglas Holtz Eakin, who directed the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office and now runs the American Action Forum, a conservative research organization. Now it's back and forth between the 10-yard lines. They do it and undo it and do it and undo it. Economists and business executives say this new era of sharp switchbacks makes it difficult for industries to plan. If there's anything that companies like less than government regulation, it is an unstable business and climate. If the regulatory changes are just whiplash or snapback, it creates a level of uncertainty that makes it very hard to build a vibrant economy, said Marty Durbin, Senior Vice President for Policy at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the nation's largest business lobby. It's not about the specific regulation or the specific candidate, Mr. Durbin said. We've got to have more long-term certainty about how business is going to be regulated. We'll be back with more of the front pages after this message.
Located in beautiful Waterford, Connecticut, Oak Hills Camp Harkness is hiring for the summer. Our fully accessible camp is designed to meet the interests and needs of children and adults along the disability spectrum by providing activities that are creative, adventurous, and fun. We are looking for counselors, lifeguards, and team leaders, just to name a few. This opportunity is perfect for recent high school graduates or college students looking to make a difference this summer. Join Oak Hill for a summer you will always remember with individuals you will never forget. Oak Hill's Camp Harkness, empowering people with disabilities. To find out more, visit oakhillct.org.
Now we'll take a look at stories that are more state-focused. Our first story is entitled, House GOP Budget, Boost K-12, Cut Care for Undocumented. Caucus budget closes holes in fiscal year 25, but lacks extra funds for higher ed. Minority House Republicans challenged their colleagues Thursday to balance the next state budget, pitching a $26 billion plan that prioritizes education but would end health care for undocumented women and children while continuing to downsize the state's workforce. The caucus plan also would plug holes involving retirement benefits and Medicaid while eliminating a highway use tax on commercial trucks and scaling back overall revenue assumptions to reflect eroding sales tax receipts. But GOP leaders also conceded there likely would be far less funds available than Democrats are seeking to invest in higher education and social services. The Republican plan, which majority Democrats likely will oppose, also would eliminate a state agency focusing on equity issues, free phone messaging for inmates, and a Medicaid expansion for older adults and persons with disabilities. The preliminary $26 billion budget the General Assembly adopted last June for the 2024 or 2025 fiscal year is about $30 million over the spending cap and lacks adequate funding for retirement benefits and Medicaid. It also no longer reflects sales tax revenue trends, which are down by more than $200 million. Majority Democrats have announced they won't formally adjust that plan despite these deficiencies. Not only is that an abdication of our constitutional obligation to balance the budget, it's also a path right back to the irresponsible fiscal practices that dogged Connecticut for years, said House Minority Leader Vincent J. Candelora, Republican, North Brantford. Democrats counter things aren't that simple. State government has more than enough money to cover all those projected holes with funds left over. But budget controls, which advocates like Governor Ned Lamont have dubbed fiscal guardrails, require that the state to save those funds, not spend them. Those saved dollars then could be used to pay down state pension debt or to build budget reserves. But Candelora said if the legislature abandons these controls, it risks pushing finances into the red sooner than many would imagine. Potential holes in next fiscal year's finances are in the range of $500 million to $600 million, while the savings cushions in the guardrail system stand at $750 million and could grow next week when revenue estimates are updated. Democrats also want to spend hundreds of millions of dollars in emergency federal pandemic relief to cover ongoing expenses next fiscal year in higher education, social services, and health care. And once those dollars are exhausted after next year, the state could be staring at deficits once again, Candelora said. Our next story is entitled THC-infused drinks found a loophole in Connecticut cannabis law. Hemp-derived products don't fall within current regulations. HB 5150 would change that and make other adjustments. Connecticut lawmakers are making final adjustments to a bill that would, for the first time, regulate the sale and potency of THC-infused beverages and other consumer products containing THC derived from hemp. While medicinal and adult-use cannabis products are highly regulated in the state, hemp-derived products with levels of THC considered intoxicating have found their way onto retail store shelves where they're sold without age restrictions. That loophole, as State Attorney General William Tong and several lawmakers have called it, originated with the Federal Agricultural Improvement Act of 2018, which legalized hemp production and subsequent state legislation that authorized it in Connecticut. That allowed hemp producers in the state to make products that have certain amounts of THC in them, said Representative Mike DiAgostino, Democrat Hamden. I'm not sure if everyone appreciated at the time that these were intoxicating THC products. Nevertheless, that's the current state of the law in Connecticut and the law that existed before we legalized cannabis. The products, which include THC-infused drinks, as well as edibles, oils, and concentrates derived from the hemp plant, are currently sold in CBD and package stores, convenience stores, supermarkets, and other retailers. Some restaurants and bars offer hemp-derived seltzers on their menus. Seltzer producers, retailers, and their customers pushed back on the regulations initially proposed in House Bill 5150, which would have limited the products to 0.5 milligrams of THC per serving. That limit was recently adjusted in the bill to 1 milligram per serving, allowing sales in package stores and cannabis dispensaries. Joe Grabowski, co-owner of Serene Craft Beer Distributors in Bridgeport, told legislators that hemp-derived beverages have helped his business remain profitable amid declining sales of alcoholic products. We are actively looking to add staff and infrastructure in 2024, but if this bill is passed as written, we will have layoffs, as our sales will no longer justify current staffing levels, Grabowski wrote in testimony submitted to the legislature's General Law Committee, which raised the bill. This is not a unique situation to just our business. The alcohol industry as a whole is suffering, and some of this is a direct result of the legislation of cannabis in this state. Our next story is entitled DEEP Greenhouse Gas Report. Connecticut is going backward. Release of emissions report comes 2 days after news of Governor Lamont being cited for cutting down 180 trees without a permit in Greenwich. Dateline Hartford. The State Department of Energy and Environmental Protection released its annual report on Connecticut's greenhouse gas emissions Thursday, revealing a mixed picture of the state's efforts to combat climate change. The report's release arrived 2 days after news broke that Governor Ned Lamont, as well as one of his neighbors and a property association, had been cited by the Greenwich Inland Wetlands Commission for illegally cutting down 180 trees in a protected wetland to improve their property's views of a nearby pond. The governor is on vacation in Florida with his family this week. This is a report that DEEP prepares every year. It's essentially Connecticut's climate report card, where we track our progress as a state in meeting the goals that the legislature has established for reducing greenhouse gas emissions across our economy, DEEP Commissioner Katie Dykes said. The DEEP's commission report covers the time frame from 1990 through 2021, with preliminary data for 2022. While emission levels dropped significantly in 2020 because of stay-at-home orders during the COVID-19 pandemic, the report shows that Connecticut has been moving in the wrong direction since. The key takeaways from this report are that emissions have increased for two consecutive years. Essentially, we saw a significant decline in emissions that happened in 2020 due to the global COVID-19 pandemic, Dyke said. And what we're seeing in the data up through 2022 is that these emissions have rebounded. So they were essentially back to the emission levels that we saw prior to the pandemic. This is not good news because we actually need to be on a trajectory of achieving a more rapid decline. According to the report released on Thursday, Connecticut has made some progress toward combating climate change. The state reached its goal of reducing emissions to 10% below 1990 levels by 2020, as set out by the Global Warming Solutions Act. However, this goal was accomplished by reducing emissions from power plants and other energy industries. The top emitter of greenhouse gases, transportation, has not seen a significant decrease since 1990. Residential use of fossil fuels for heating and other purposes is the second highest emitter of emissions. Our next story is entitled, "The Problem with Accessing Opioid Treatment in Parts of Connecticut, Getting There." State officials want to fill in the map for methadone treatment. State officials and nonprofit providers are spending millions of dollars to increase access to methadone in Connecticut and to eliminate one of the biggest barriers to that opioid treatment medication, travel times. Several of the state's methadone providers are in the process of setting up or are in the process of siting and opening new methadone treatment centers in Connecticut, including the first clinic of its kind in Middlesex County. At the same time, state officials are preparing to spend more than $4 million from a pool of opioid settlement funds to outfit two new methadone vans, which will be capable of dispensing the vital medication to patients in more isolated corners of the state. Those investments are key to Connecticut's larger goal of expanding medication-assisted treatment in the state, including methadone, which is widely considered to be the most effective treatment for people with a history of using heroin, fentanyl, or prescription painkillers. There are roughly 30 inpatient clinics located throughout Connecticut that dispense methadone to individuals seeking treatment for opioid use disorders. But with many of those federally licensed centers located in the state's larger cities, there is concern that pockets of Connecticut still don't have a level of access that is necessary to combat the ongoing opioid epidemic, which claimed the lives of more than 6,300 Connecticut residents in the past 5 years. To highlight that point, a team of researchers from Yale University and Virginia Tech University recently completed a study for Connecticut that calculated how long it takes for residents in every part of the state to travel by car, bus, or train to the nearest methadone clinic. For some Connecticut residents, it takes 30 to 90 minutes to drive to receive methadone treatment. That analysis showed that for people living in and around cities like Waterbury, Hartford, Danbury, New Haven, Bridgeport, Stamford, Torrington, Norwich, and New London, it often takes less than 15 minutes by car to get to the nearest methadone clinic. But in other sections of Connecticut, it can take more than 45 minutes to drive to the closest treatment center, which can be a major impediment for people who are undergoing methadone treatment while also attempting to maintain a job or care for their families. Imagine being stuck in traffic, knowing you have to get dosed and you have to get back to work, or you have to get your kid on the school bus, said Nancy Navaretta, the commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Unsurprisingly, the time commitment is even bigger for people who don't have access to a car. We'll be back with more of the front pages after this message.
The American School for the Deaf Online Academy is the first accessible online education platform for deaf and hard of hearing students, serving over 200 students from around the world. It offers core academic subjects for middle and high school students, tutoring, enrichment programs, and American Sign Language as a world language courses for public schools. The program recently expanded to also provide accessible support services, including speech therapy and counseling. This telecare program offers direct access to therapeutic services for deaf and hard of hearing school-aged children without the need for an interpreter or third party. To learn more, visit their website, asd-1817.org. The American School for the Deaf. Always able.
Now's the time when we read obituaries by town. Avon, Tommy L. Davis. Bloomfield, Carolyn Schnatz. Carol Smith. Bristol, Teresa E. Torello. Broadbrook, Martha H. Kotoa. Cromwell, Thad E. Gillickson. East Haddam, Richard Seidel. East Hartford, Leah L. Wallace, Richard R. Washburn. Essex, Sharon Clark. Farmington, Cornelia L. Russell. Glastonbury, Myron Cusio. Gregory Lucas. Lee C. Milligan. James W. Ritter. Hartford, Vincent Castro. James B. DeFranzo. Joyce K. Dello. Isabel Hooker. Vincent J. Mazzarella. Lawrence H. Norona. Hebron, Lee C. Milligan. Manchester, Joanne Nesteruk. Dr. Ramon A. Nieto. Middletown, Fred Hill. New Britain, Arthur Adolphson III. Rebecca L. Riley. Simsbury, Jane McDonough. South Windsor, Virginia Scheller. West Hartford, Mary M. Frost. Sedonia M. Lamone. Wethersfield, Poolnath Hiraposhad. And Windsor, Dorothy B. Pinard. Well, now let's take a look at what's on TV for today. We'll be looking at primetime and the main channels, starting with CBS. They have a new episode of The Equalizer running from 8 to 9 p.m. That's followed by a new episode of Tracker running from 9 to 10 p.m. And that's followed by a new episode of CSI Vegas running from 10 to 11 p.m. On NBC, they start the evening with The Voice, running from 8 to 10 p.m. That's followed by an episode of Dateline NBC running from 10 to 11 p.m., and that is a new episode. It looks like it's a night of comedy on Fox. They start the evening with an episode of The Simpsons running from 8 to 8:30 p.m. That's followed by a new episode of Crapopolis running from 8:30 to 9 p.m. That's followed by a new episode of The Great North running from 9 to 9:30 p.m. And they close out the evening with a new episode of Grimsburg running from 9:30 to 10 p.m. On PBS, coming out of both Hartford, WEDH, and out of Springfield, WGBY, they are running the same schedule tonight. And that is, they start the evening with a new episode of Call the Midwife, running from 8 to 9 p.m. That's followed by Mr. Bates versus the Post Office on Masterpiece, running from 9 to 10 p.m. And that's followed by Guilt on Masterpiece, running from 10 to 11 p.m. On ABC, they have an episode of American Idol running from 8 to 10 p.m., followed by a new episode of Michael Strahan versus Jon Bon Jovi, Halfway There, running from 10 to 11 p.m. On TBS, they have the Stanley Cup playoff running from 8 to 10 p.m., and another game of the Stanley Cup playoff running from 10:30 p.m. until approximately 12:30 a.m. On ESPN, they have Major League Baseball running from 7 to approximately 10 p.m., and that's followed by two episodes of SportsCenter running from 10 to 11 p.m. and 11 p.m. until midnight. On the USA Network, it looks like it's a night of Law & Order Special Victims Unit, with three episodes running from 8 to 9, 9 to 10, and 10 to 11 p.m. And finally on TLC, they have a new episode of 90 Day Fiancé, Happily Ever After, running from 8 to 10 p.m. That's followed by a new episode of MILF Manor, running from 10 to 11 p.m. And that's followed by a new episode of 90 Day Fiancé, Pillow Talk, Happily Ever After, running from approximately 11:15 p.m. until midnight. Well, now get out those lottery tickets, because these are the lottery numbers from Saturday, April 27th. Play 3 Day, 5, 1, 6, Wild Ball 5. Play 4 Day, 5, 3, 8, 1, Wild Ball 6. The late numbers were not drawn in time for the edition that I am reading from, but we do have Friday's late numbers, and they are Play 3 Night, 2, 7, 0, Wild Ball 6. Play 4 Night, 6, 9, 9, 2, Wild Ball 0. Cash 5, 4, 10, 17, 19, 33. Lucky for Life, 11, 15, 27, 28, 46, Lucky Ball 7. Lotto, 4, 12, 17, 35, 42, 44. There were 0 first prize tickets sold. Mega Millions, 15, 23, 53, 57, 61. Mega Ball 9, Mega Plier 3. Tuesday's estimated Lotto jackpot, $2.5 million. Tuesday's estimated Mega Millions jackpot, $257 million. Well, now let's take a look at the almanac. Today is Sunday, April 28th, the last Sunday in April of 2024. It's the 119th day of 2024. There are 247 days left in the year. Today in history. In 1788, Maryland became the seventh state to ratify the Constitution of the United States. In 1945, Italian dictator Benito Mussolini and his mistress, Clara Petacci, were executed by Italian partisans as they attempted to flee the country. In 1947, a six-man expedition set out from Peru aboard the balsa wood raft named Contiki, on a 101-day journey across the Pacific Ocean to the Polynesian Islands. In 1952, war with Japan officially ended as a treaty signed in San Francisco the year before took effect. In 1967, heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali was stripped of his title after he refused to be inducted into the armed forces. In 1980, President Jimmy Carter accepted the resignation of Secretary of State Cyrus R. Vance, who had opposed the failed rescue mission aimed at freeing American hostages in Iran. In 1986, the Soviet Union informed the world of the nuclear disaster at Chernobyl that began 2 days earlier. In 1990, the musical A Chorus Line closed after 6,137 performances on Broadway. And in 2021, Apollo 11 astronaut Michael Collins, who orbited the moon while Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin made their first steps on the lunar surface, died of cancer in Florida at age 90. Today's birthdays: former Secretary of State James A. Baker III is 94. Actress-singer Anne Margaret, who has starred in such 60s movies as Pocketful of Miracles, State Fair, Bye Bye Birdie, and Viva Las Vegas, is 83. Former Tonight Show host Jay Leno is 74. Actress Mary McDonnell, who played the roles of Stands with a Fist in the movie Dances with Wolves, and First Lady Marilyn Whitmore in the movie Independence Day, is 72. Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan is 64. Actress Bridget Moynihan, who stars as Erin Reagan in the CBS police drama Blue Bloods, is 53. Actress Penelope Cruz, who has had roles in such notable films as Volver, Nine, Vanilla Sky, and Ferrari, is 50. HGTV personalities Drew and Jonathan Scott are 46. And actress Jessica Alba, who rose to prominence at age 19 as the lead actress of the television series Dark Angel, is 43. Well, that's all for this edition of The Front Pages. I'm Lisa Bowman, along with Scott Becker, and I've been reading from today's Hartford Courant, New York Times, and Manchester Journal-Enquirer. If you missed any part of this program, it will air again this evening at 6 and 11. It's also available anytime on our telephone reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great day, everyone.